Word of mouth.
Time is fleeting. Madness takes its toll. But listen closely.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Tomorrow marks the 40th anniversary of the release of the longest running film in continuous release ever. And no, not E.T., which ran for over a year, or Back to the Future, which lasted 9 months. I'm talking about the Rocky Horror Picture Show, the musical comedy horror melange starring Tim Curry and Susan Sarandon. Based on a musical that premiered in 1973, the film flopped at the box office, but soon became a cult classic, spurring a continuous run in theaters that has not ended since 1975. Audiences still flock to theaters to participate in ritualistic antics, shouting lines and throwing dry toast. The Fox Cable Network recently announced that it will remake Rocky Horror for the small screen. June Thomas is a Slate cultural critic and editor of Outward, that's Slate's LGBTQ section. She's here to talk about the cultural legacy of Rocky Horror. And June, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
So you admit to being a Rocky Horror Picture Show veteran. Remind us, please, of the plot.
Oh, the plot. Gosh. You know, it's funny. The plot is in many ways the least interesting part of the movie, but essentially two partners, I guess we would call them at this point, a girlfriend, boyfriend, they leave a wedding in Denton and they get lost on a rainy road and they find themselves at a spooky house. And they discover when they get there, there's some kind of event going on. There are all these strange people who are looking forward to welcoming someone or other. Then they discover Frank N. Furter, who is, he's a transsexual from Transylvania, the musical tells us. And he is spectacular, tall and beautiful, elements of both male and female, wearing fishnet tights and a bustier and makeup. But at the same time, with quite masculine tones. And Frank N. Furter, is also creating a man. He's creating a beautiful creature for himself who's wearing little gold shorts. Then it all kind of falls apart, but only after a sort of orgiastic romp in a swimming pool when Frank tells us that we should give ourselves over to absolute pleasure.
Well, that was pretty well done, I have to say, June.
Thank you.
When did you first see the Rocky Horror Picture Show? And I'm guessing you didn't grow up in some suburb in America.
That's right. I did grow up in England, and I actually saw it, first of all, in London. I guess in the early 80s, I would say about 1982, you know, so on the stage. But then when I came to America, also in 1982, my first time living in America, I was in Newark, Delaware, the home of the University of Delaware. And Newark is a college town, but back in those days, it wasn't a totally progressive place. So there was a gay and lesbian student union, but anybody who was sort of known to be a member of that group might be subject to harassment on the street. And yet, every Saturday night at the State Theater on Main Street, people queued up outside to go to the Rocky Horror Picture Show showing and also to perform. And it was really something very different, something really quite radical for Newark, Delaware's Main Street. And you really had the feeling that this was a very important spot. You know, it wasn't a gay bar, and there was no saying that anybody, certainly anybody at all in the place, was gay. And yet, there was something very liberating, very liberated about the show. It was a chance to dress up, to, you know, say the things that Frank says that are not always positive. I mean, there's some sort of rather creepy elements to the story, you know, involving consent and murder and cannibalism. It's not a sort of a perky, upbeat story. And yet there is also this element of being free and just allowing yourself to sort of follow your dreams and not get stuck in convention.
I want to go back to that, you know, the kind of idea that even these predominantly heterosexual populations, like I'm thinking of in 1982, college student population. You have men dressing up in fishnet tights, women dressing up in also fishnet tights, but, you know, sort of putting on this guise of Tim Curry playing Dr. Frank N. Furter. So certainly it didn't normalize queerness in any kind of way, but do you think it made it more visible?
I definitely think it made it more visible. And, you know, again, I'm not saying that anybody in that crowd was gay, but it was definitely a queer atmosphere. As I said, it was very much a place where you could try things on and try things out and just kind of escape the kind of confines of conventionality, which is in many ways the message of the show. And I would also say that something earlier you described it as ritualistic, which I think is a very good way of putting it. You know, there are these things that you do during the show. You throw toast when they say a toast, or you put a newspaper over your head when Janet and Brad do that, or, you know, spray a water gun. Now, these things, which, as I even say them, must be hell for a theater. It must involve a lot of cleaning up of things that are much messier than popcorn and Coca-Cola. But, you know, learning what you did, because in those days, this is even before VCRs, you couldn't just go home and watch it and practice. You had to go there every week. And it was almost like becoming part of a community. You learned what you said. You learned the cues and the way to behave. And those people who were up front reenacting the show in front of the screen, they'd learned it that way too. And so it was really a matter of kind of earning your entree into a particular group. And again, not that any of those people necessarily were gay, that does mirror the gay lifestyle, to use a strange phrase, certainly back in those days. Nowadays it's different, but you know, you had to find the gay bar, which wasn't necessarily easy to find. You had to learn the language, the lingo. You had to figure out just the sort of way to behave there that wasn't the same as everywhere else. So there were a lot of parallels that I suspect a lot of people found just very reassuring and comforting.
And the movie did come out in 1975, before AIDS, certainly.
Yeah, there are some, as I said earlier, there's some creepy things in the movie, you know.
Is it gay sex positive, this film?
I think it is, because Frank does love Rocky, who he creates, his creature. But there are some things that he does with both men and women that are certainly not enlightened. His respect for consent is not very obvious. And as I say, he's a cannibal. He kills someone who threatens his position and then serves him up at dinner, which is, you know, it's a satire on horror movies. So, of course, we would want that. And another thing that I think is less obvious, perhaps, but it is a kind of a love story to those old movies. That comes up in the great opening song, you know, that's one of the first things that you would yell at the screen would be lips, lips, lips. And that was the call for the first image, which is of these lips that are disembodied from a face or anything else that would just sing the song. And that song is really a tribute to the kind of classic golden age movies from Hollywood.
Well, the film has been around for 40 years now, so it's very conceivable that kids of parents who went to Rocky Horror and participated are now going. And that it's high schoolers in the suburbs. You know, they all at least know what Rocky Horror is. So how does Rocky Horror fit into this whole history of cult films?
Well, it seems to have been the first. I mean, I imagine that there were always people wanting to go to midnight movies. But I mean, I remember first hearing of the sort of reenactments and the participation in Rocky Horror by a scene in the film Fame, you know, which came out about the same time. And that was really what made me want to go to my first performance, because I knew the musical by that point. I didn't really know what I was going to get out of it. But that kind of builds up this sense of, oh, this is something interesting that you can only get in that room once a week or however often it's shown. But, you know, you can't just do that in your home on Tuesday night. This is something special. And I think that that's the key to these cult films. Nowadays, of course, we can see movies whenever we want. You know, we have DVDs and streaming and just many more options. You know, we don't have to make special trips anymore. But if you want to have the sort of specialness of cult films, is this idea of seeing them with other people, of being in a room and having some kind of shared experience. And I think these cult films still have that in a way that you don't necessarily have for the latest big budget movie. It's harder to justify, for me at least, even as a great lover of cinema, paying, you know, the very high prices when nowadays we all have these nice big TVs and so on, or many of us do. For me, something special and a sort of shared experience makes going to the movies really much more interesting than just to see even a very good film, even a film that's actually much better than Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Well, June, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
June Thomas, she's a Slate culture critic and editor of Outward. That's Slate's LGBTQ section.
Butter, deltoid.